For a clearinghouse of neurology-related information on the coronavirus, go to aan.com/COVID-19 to stay up to date.
Thanks for tuning in for the April 28th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's What's Trending interview features an update on delirium. For the featured interview, you'll hear a discussion on nocturnal blood pressure and cognition. Please remember we offer free CME to AAN members for each eligible podcast, and we welcome your feedback at podcast@aan.com.
Hi, this is Greg Day from Mayo Clinic, Florida. I have the pleasure of speaking with Sharon Inouye from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School. Dr. Inouye is a world-renowned expert on the diagnosis and management of delirium and has published numerous research manuscripts on the topic. However, today we're going to be discussing her article published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which approaches delirium from a decidedly more personal perspective. Thanks for joining me today.
I'm delighted to be here, Greg. Thank you for having me.
Your article, Joining Forces Against Delirium from Organ System Care to Whole Human Care, discusses your experience with the assessment and management of a very special 72-year-old patient who had a complicated hospital admission, then following a coronary artery syndrome. If I was to just provide that overall statement, I think many of our listeners might be wondering or would wonder what's so unique about such a routine clinical scenario.
Well, Greg, the unique aspect of that case is that the patient in the feature was my father. And my father was a beloved family physician in Southern California. And he was also my hero and my role model and the reason that I actually went into the field of medicine. And so presenting his case was particularly important and personal to me because at that point, I was already a world's expert in delirium, and as I sat at his bedside, I realized that I could not help him. And the reason for that was I realized that it really takes a coordinated medical care system in order to prevent delirium. So my father's delirium was from multiple causes, including the surgery, the coronary syndrome, as you mentioned, and then he went on to get bypass surgery. He had general anesthesia. He also developed acute renal failure from the contrast prior to the surgery, and he had underlying diabetes. He also lost his hearing during that admission due to acute immunoglycoside toxicity. And on top of that, he received over 20 medications that had psychoactive side effects for pain, for nausea, and then when he developed agitation, he was also immobilized. He had an indwelling Foley catheter. He wasn't allowed to sleep as is routine in the hospital, and he had impaired nutrition from what he considered an unpalatable diet. And the most striking thing, the realization that I had and that I focused on in the article was really how uncoordinated his care was with 7 different consultation teams taking care of him and no one overall, you know, conductor or coach overseeing everything such that he didn't wind up on all these different medications, which ended up really causing and exacerbating the delirium. And I did want to add that, you know, this scenario and the relevance of this topic is extremely important as we're grappling with the COVID-19 pandemic, because as we all know, it typically and especially impacts on older adults in a severe way, and they are at very high risk for delirium. And we're already seeing spikes in delirium and encephalopathy during the course of hospitalization, during the course of ICU stay. And so it really is a huge and relevant issue now. And so I'm really glad that we're discussing this.
Well, thank you for that detailed recap. I think you created or highlighted a few paradoxes in what you said. And first off, it sounds like your father was getting what we would call by standard of care, high quality care, multiple physician teams working together, targeting multiple different medical issues. But The paradox there is that all of that, what should be a coordinated care, resulted in multiple medications, multiple other risk factors that sprung up that weren't managed in a consistent way. And as you've detailed, even more likely to occur nowadays when our medical system is stretched even thinner and the burden is even higher.
Absolutely. I think that was one of the points as we've advanced our technology, as we've advanced our therapeutic approaches, and care has gotten more and more advanced and specialized in a way that's taken us away from the bedside and has really maybe led to the difficulty with recognizing and management of delirium, I think, in an important way. I think a lot of times physicians are depending on the technology, and also they're so busy, you know, ordering tests, tracking down results, discussing those results in this really technologically focused care that we have. And again, that allows little time at the bedside for just conversation, assessment of mental status, and really tracking patients' mental status over time. So this disruption in the time at the bedside and sort of continuity of care and coordination of care for the individual patient, I think, has also happened.
Beyond sort of dissecting all of these individual contributors, I mean, I really think your article does a great job of communicating to the reader the human impact of delirium, what ends up resulting from the effect on a single patient that spreads towards family and everyone else that might be involved in care. Your article, though, also does a really good job of pointing out the wider cost of delirium on a system-wide perspective. So I think you cite in-hospital mortality rates of 25 to 33%, and most staggeringly, annual healthcare costs that exceed somewhere north of $180 billion and additional long-term morbidity. So highlighting all of these problems, I think we can begin to ask that question of how can we afford not to address these issues on a system-wide level? And what are some suggestions that you might offer from your experience lived at the bedside and also your experience in the research realm there?
Yeah, so I think that absolutely it's a huge problem. And I think, you know, the reasons that it's overlooked or not recognized and not managed actually are pretty complex. You know, I've talked about the lack of time at the bedside, the technologic focus, the rushed nature of care. There's intense pressure, you know, to get people out of the hospital quickly. The lack of coordination, the lack of continuity in some cases. There's also really, I think, a large contribution of a lack of awareness by many clinicians about the importance of delirium, how serious it is, and really how to recognize it and manage it. And I see this in, you know, across the board, across nursing staff, clinicians. I even see this among family members as well. And I think there is a component of ageism there, you know. There's, I think, a deeply held belief by some that it's okay for an older person to become confused in the hospital. In fact, I've even heard that from some of my colleagues that, you know, older patients, this just happens to them when they're in the hospital, like it's something normalizing. And I hear that from family members as well. And I really try to get that message out there that, you know, it's not okay. And even more importantly, it's a signal that something's going wrong.
As a geriatrician, in particular, as a recognized expert in delirium, you were definitely in a good position to identify the medical and iatrogenic complications that interfered with your father's recovery, and I thank you for sharing those with us. Yet, you also share another experience, and that's really recognizing that you encountered some challenges when you attempted to communicate those impressions to the clinical team. So could you share with us and our listeners any advice that you might have for either family members, junior clinicians, medical students, or other members of the clinical team, advice on how they can advocate for the brain health of the person or patient in front of them?
Yeah, so Greg, that's a really important point. First of all, it's really important to be knowledgeable about what delirium is and how to assess it. And I just want to let your audience know about materials that are available on our website at hospitalelderlifeprogram.org. So all one word, hospitalelderlifeprogram.org. And there you can find a lot of information for patients and family members, for clinicians and physicians about delirium, educational materials, resources, for family members. There's the 10 tips if you know you're coming to the hospital, what you should know about what delirium is and how to prevent it. For family members in particular, I would like to send out the word and empower them that it's really important if they notice changes in their loved one to bring it to the attention of the clinicians as early as possible, because really it's the family members that can recognize those changes early on and really to bring that to the awareness of the clinicians. That's often the first warning sign we have. As a geriatrician, I've learned this. When the family says, my family member is just not right, that's like my leading indication to go right in the room and assess for delirium. And I think for other clinicians, requesting a geriatrics consult can often be very helpful in the setting to assist both with the assessment and then sort of the multifactorial evaluation and working with the family and coordinating the care. It can be very helpful. So those are some of my helpful hints, which I hope can lead to empowerment of both family members and clinicians in advocating for brain health.
Perfect. So being knowledgeable about facts, paying attention to changes in our patients, and not hesitating to ask for help from those that have experience when needed. I really appreciate your willingness to share your experience with us today. And I thank you in particular for your uniquely personal contribution to the medical literature on this critically important topic.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for having me on today.
I've been speaking with Dr. Inoue, lead author on the paper titled Joining Forces Against Delirium, From Organ System Care to Whole Human Care, which you can and should read in the February 6th edition of the New England Journal of Medicine.
Hi, this is Dan Ackerman from St. Luke's University Health Network in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And today, for the Neurology Podcast, I have the pleasure of talking with Adam Brickman from the Taub Institute and the Department of Neurology at Columbia University in New York. Today, we will be discussing his paper titled, White Matter Hyperintensities Mediate the Association of Nocturnal Blood Pressure with Cognition in the April 28th issue of Neurology. Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks so much. It's my pleasure to speak with you.
This was a really interesting paper. As neurologists, we're very frequently asked to see patients with abnormal MRIs, and very often white matter hyperintensities are the reason for that referral. What can the practicing neurologist learn from your study about seeing these patients?
White matter hyperintensities, we used to sort of think of these as lesions that were maybe benign or subclinical. And I think more and more literature is pointing to the idea that white matter hyperintensities are pernicious and they're not silent. Rather, I think of them as quiet or subclinical harbingers of risk for stroke and cognitive decline in older adults in particular. So our study confirms that white matter hyperintensities are indeed related to cognitive abilities and that nocturnal blood pressure and overall blood pressure might be some of the drivers of these increased hyperintensities we see in some middle-aged and older adults.
Okay, so just to make sure I understood that correctly, we're saying that not only are these white matter hyperintensities potentially responsible for some of the memory issues that so many of our patients complain about, but that actually, specifically in patients with vascular risk and high blood pressure, there may be a connection between their type of blood pressure, blood pressure control, and the white matter hyperintensities leading to the memory changes. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So the idea here is that what we've known for a while now is that high blood pressure or hypertension is a risk factor for developing white matter hyperintensities, and these in turn are associated with cognitive decline or memory issues in older adults. And in our study, what we were able to look at is 24-hour blood pressure monitoring. And in addition to having hypertension, individuals who were reverse dippers, those people whose blood pressure doesn't normally decline in the nighttime, they had particularly elevated white matter hyperintensities and particularly lower memory ability.
Wow. And that's actually a perfect lead into my next question, because even as a stroke neurologist who deals with blood pressure very frequently, I was not very familiar with this concept of dipping and non-dipping and reverse dipping. I thought that was an ice cream thing.
Right.
So could you explain that a little bit for our listeners?
Sure. Well, the cardiologists have been interested in this for some time. The idea is that blood pressure varies throughout the day, throughout the 24-hour period. And at nighttime, while we're ostensibly sleeping, blood pressure should naturally dip, should go down a little bit. And if it doesn't dip, we call it non-dipping. And if it, in fact, increases at night, we call it reverse dipping. Now, previous literature has linked non-dipping and reverse dipping to poor outcomes, poor medical outcomes, death, major cardiac events, things like that. Among the first papers, I think, ours shows that this reverse dipping, this lack of decrease in blood pressure at night, and in fact an increase in blood pressure at night, is associated with markers of cerebrovascular disease.
Wow, so this is really something we need to become more familiar with and cognizant of. How did you relate memory function to the white matter and hyperintensities and the blood pressure? What's the link between them?
So you mean in terms of how did we measure those different elements, or how did we do it statistically or analytically?
Yeah, analytically, how did you elucidate that connection?
So what we did was we were able to collect 24-hour blood pressure measurements in a large cohort of community-dwelling middle-aged adults. And we calculated their blood pressure over the 24-hour period and divided individuals into whether they were normal dippers, that is, their blood pressure declined, non-dippers at night, that is, their blood pressure stayed about the same at night as it was during the day, and reverse dippers, those individuals whose blood pressure increased at night relative to the day. And we also collected MRI scans, structural MRI scans, including T2-weighted flare scans, and quantitated white matter hyperintensities with some software that we've written in my laboratory. And the participants in the study also participated in a neuropsychological assessment where we did a neuropsychological battery to measure their different thinking abilities, including memory functioning. Basically, what we did was we divided individuals into whether or not they had hypertension over the 24-hour period and looked at their dipping and non-dipping characteristics at night and examined their performance on the neuropsychological battery and their white matter hyperintensity volume on the MRI scan. And we used some statistical approaches to test mediation. That is the question of whether the reverse dipping status that we observed caused statistically the increased white matter hyperintensities, which in turn caused the lower memory performance that we observed in them.
Wow. So you had how many participants in the study again?
So this study included 435 middle-aged adults. They were on average about 60 years old, 59 years old.
Wow, that's really powerful to have 435 people to be able to get ambulatory blood pressure monitoring along with MRI with expert evaluation. So I have to ask at this point, should I be ordering ambulatory blood pressure monitors for all my patients that have white matter hyperintensities?
So I don't know if the recommendation for every patient who has memory loss or white matter hyperintensity should in fact get a 24-hour blood pressure monitoring, but I think it's reasonable for individuals who are hypertensive or on hypertension medication to monitor their blood pressure over a 24-hour period to see or to assess the extent of their risk for cerebrovascular events and cognitive impairment.
Okay, so let's say that I'm following a patient with a prior stroke who asks for a repeat MRI due to concerns over short-term memory loss. Because I will say, in the history of my practice, I've probably only had two people that have come in and said, wow, my memory is my strong point. Mm-hmm. Everyone seems concerned about their memory. So how would you approach that kind of a question in light of your study?
Well, I think when our patients have concerns about their memory, I think an important element is that we characterize their complaints with a formal neuropsychological evaluation. And sometimes patients say, oh, I have memory problems, but what they're really talking about is the tension or executive dysfunction, things like that. So the first thing we want to do is characterize their cognitive profile with a neuropsychological assessment. I think MRI can help in the diagnostic workup because if there's a lot of small vessel cerebrovascular disease, like white matter hyperintensities, that might point to potentially controllable risk factors like hypertension and poor blood pressure control. So I think with the typical patient who comes into our clinics with vascular risk factors, it's always a good idea to do the full behavioral workup as well.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. Well, this is a really interesting paper with a lot of great clinical applications. Adam, thank you so much for talking with us today. Again, we've been talking with Adam Brickman about his paper titled White Matter Hyperintensities Mediate the Association of Nocturnal Blood Pressure with Cognition. And I would encourage all of our listeners to look up the full paper in the April 28th edition of Neurology.
Thanks so much.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article on long-term exposure to air pollution and trajectories of cognitive decline among older adults, and another article on meta-analysis of drug efficacy in adult versus pediatric trials for patients with PGTC seizures. Please take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.